When you send, when you finish your papers, send them to me digitally, as well as give me a hard copy next week. But I write comments on the digital copy. And it's actually more convenient for me since I read it online, you know, I read it on my computer when I write comments, for it to be single-spaced, just because otherwise I'll reformat it to single-spaced anyway. So you might as well send it to me single-spaced. Be sure to paginate your copy. Sometimes I would say roughly 10% of the time students hand in papers, they forget to paginate them. So when I write comments that refer to pages, I have to paginate it before. So since I'm going to do it anyway, you might as well do it before. That's all. Thanks to almost everybody sent me their comments about the two questions I asked about the class. The general consensus were that people were reasonably happy with how things were going. They found the discussions that, as they have emerged, interesting, and that my digressions from the course they felt were fine. They, you know, usually added stuff. There were lots of specific suggestions of one sort or another, which I will be attentive to. On the procedural issue of whether or not we should break down, most people felt that the co-mentoring groups were accomplishing at least part of what breaking down in the class would accomplish, that is giving everybody a chance to talk and think out loud about the material. And that was both an indicator to me that the co-mentoring groups were actually working. That people were meeting. I mean, I know people are meeting because I get your affirmations to that effect, but that they were actually an occasion for people to share ideas and to talk. Still, there were a few people, you know, a significant minority, not just one or two people, who felt that sometimes it might be good, even here, to have a short breakdown at some point in the lecture. Partially because then people could meet with people other than their co-mentoring group, and it would be a way to meet other people in the class more. And, you know, so I think I will try to, you know, every three or four lectures find a space where we can, for 15 or 20 minutes, just quickly break down into small groups to discuss the themes that we have been working on. But mostly I'm just going to roll along as we've been rolling, okay? All right. So last time we began the discussion of the micro foundations of a theory of class formation by focusing on the concept of solidarity and trying to give solidarity a little bit more precise theoretical formulation through the language of game theory, which, just to repeat a point, I prefer to call strategic interaction theory rather than game theory. And that also helps to highlight what is it about the theory or the framework that is relevant to a study of class formation. Since every theory of class struggle imagines that classes are not just struggling in some frenetic way, that the actors, the human beings engaged in such struggles, are engaged in strategies. They think about what other people are going to do and try to mobilize a set of actions in light of what they anticipate other people to do. And that's all that strategy means. What it means to have a strategy is that you have a set of ideas about what you can do now to influence what's possible in the future, what will happen in the future, that takes into consideration what other people are going to do. To act strategically is to act with the knowledge that other people are acting strategically. You're not the only thinking, purposeful person. And you have to take people's purposes and intentions into account in deciding what you yourself are going to do. And that's, of course, at the very core of what a union does. When a union is debating about a strike, what do they argue about? What's the employer going to do? What are the cops going to do? What the employer is going to do matters for the decision of a union to go on strike, because the possibilities of succeeding in a strike depends in part upon what an employer will do in response to it. If you know with 100% certainty that if you go on strike, the employer is going to close down the factory and move it abroad, you know that's absolutely for sure what's going to happen. And that everybody who goes on strike is going to lose their jobs. End of story. That's what is going to happen. That should affect what the union decides to do. Now, you know, the world is complicated. A union leadership, perhaps even the members, could say, damn it, this is so intolerable. Even if that's the certain outcome, it's still worth going on strike because we want to demonstrate to the world that we're not the kind of people that just lay down and get trampled on. So people can, for expressive reasons, reasons of personal integrity and affirmation of their autonomy as persons, decide to engage in a struggle knowing that they're going to lose. But knowing you're going to lose is still a strategy. It still means that you're taking into account what the other actor in question will do. So that's what strategic interaction theory is. Now, the argument I made in the last lecture, which tracks fairly closely Jan Elster's arguments, is that solidarity as a key component of class formation can be given theoretical precision if we understand it in these terms. And in Elster's terms then, solidarity reflects a situation in which members of a class have conditional altruist preferences, and the game they are playing is what is called an assurance game. They're not playing a prisoner's dilemma. What they are playing, the game they are in, is an assurance game. Now remember the word assurance in the assurance game. That word indicates that the key problem in the game is information. An assurance game is a game in which the participants in the game want to cooperate with other people. That's their highest preference. Their highest preference is not to simply get the biggest personal payoff. They do not want to be a free rider. They want to participate so long as everyone else, or everyone else subject to some threshold condition, participates. So they need assurance about other people's behavior. They are thus conditional altruists, not unconditional altruists. I think where we left off was in Roman numeral 3 on page 6, discussing what the implications of this were for the empirical problem of the conditions under which solidarity is likely to be high and effective. And let me just briefly run through, I think, three central points. These are all points in which Elster analyzes some of Marx's ideas about class struggle and embeds them in this game theory framework, shows how what Marx is doing in some of his empirical discussions of class struggle, what he's doing is identifying the social conditions for solidarity, where solidarity is understood as conditional altruism, operating in an assurance game. Okay, so the first empirical claim is that the concentration and interdependence of workers in large factories increases the likelihood of solidaristic struggles. There are many places in Marx's work where he makes the observation that in the course of capitalist development, the organization of production changes from small, fragmented sites of production, labor processes that are dispersed into small firms, that in the course of capitalist development, that is transformed increasingly into large concentrations of workers in which, within the labor process itself, they are highly interdependent. So you can imagine large concentrations of workers without interdependence. In the early Industrial Revolution, there were large concentrations of workers brought under one roof with relatively little interdependence. Essentially, the same technologies that were used in cottage industry, a loom, for example, run by an individual worker, were simply brought together under a large roof. The initial movement of looms in weaving from small cottages to large factories, large warehouse, you know, large buildings, the original reason for doing it was not because it had any technological advantages whatsoever. It wasn't because in a large factory where you had hundreds of looms, you could then have steam power rather than hand power running the looms. But the original reason for moving it was that it made it cheaper to have surveillance. It meant that the supervision of workers was less expensive. And the big problem that in cottage industry capitalists faced was theft. Workers stole thread. There's a really interesting story about the very early stages of the Industrial Revolution. And cottage industry had the following form. The workers owned their own looms, often. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes the loom was also provided by a capitalist. But in the archetypal cottage industry, the worker owned the loom, but didn't own any of the inputs into production. They didn't own, they didn't have any capital, so they couldn't just buy on the market thread, yarn to do the weaving, and they had no way of selling the product, the cloth that they would make. So what the capitalist did was provide the inputs into production, the threads, the yarn, and took the product and then paid the loom operator, typically on a piece rate. That's the simplest way that you would do it. Here's the problem. The capitalist provides 1,000 pounds of yarn, of the raw material. If the weaver takes 1% of that and makes a slightly less high density product, it's very hard at the output side to measure. It's very expensive to measure whether there's missing threads. But then gradually the weaver accumulates a substantial amount of yarn, which they can then make their own cloth and sell on a black market, in effect. Weavers were extremely good at cheating capitalists. That was one problem. The other problem was that weavers only wanted to work as long and hard as necessary to provide for their basic subsistence. Capitalists wanted them to work longer and harder. And it was very difficult under the decentralized conditions of cottage industry for capitalists to force the workers to work harder. It also made it easier for workers to have more than one kind of job. They would have small plots as well as weaving. The initial decision to move looms into factories was simply to increase surveillance. You eliminated threat, and you could force workers to work longer and harder. Once workers were brought into production in large factories, it then became possible for the capitalists to rationalize and increase productivity through a more refined division of labor, and then eventually through the application of steam power to the production process. So the technical change, the improvement of the forces of production, was something that resulted from an initial transformation that was driven by social conditions of production. There are some very interesting historical pieces on this. This was a big debate in the 1970s. I think in some places in one of the supplementary topics in the syllabus, this is, the references are all present. I don't remember them off the top of my head for this change. Okay, so this is another digression from the main course of the argument here. That was just concentration of workers. Workers, concentration means more and more workers are brought together under one roof. But it wasn't yet interdependence. What happens increasingly in the course of capitalist development is that the labor process within a capitalist firm becomes more interdependent. Workers' ability to work depends increasingly on other workers' work. They increasingly have to rely on each other in the actual day-to-day operation of production. So one of the things, so what does this have to do with solidarity? You know, solidarity is, requires, as I stated in laying out the problem, two conditions. The preference ordering of workers needs to be conditional altruist. Workers want to cooperate with each other in struggles, so if others do. And they need information. They need assurance that other people will work. Well, concentration and interdependence affects both of those problems. Interdependence and concentration means that you see many more workers on a daily basis. When you're working just in a cottage, you don't interact with other workers. You don't get to know them. They're abstract categories. They're not concrete persons. In a large factory, you see many other workers. You get to know some of them extremely well. Others you know by name. You live in a named environment of people, real people, not abstract people. Which means you get to know which of them are reliable and which are not. You have a sense of what the values and shared identities of your fellow workers are. You talk to each other waiting in line to go in the morning. You talk to each other in pubs afterwards. You get to know your fellow workers through this increased concentration. But also your preferences begin to change, because in countless ways, in the daily operation of a factory, workers defend each other. Or not, you know, I mean, you can be in a situation where workers are constantly screwing each other. So concentration could have the effect of making people even more self-centered and free-riding with respect to struggle, because they realize everybody's out to screw everybody. That's one possibility. But in fact, what happens in most cases in large factories is workers are constantly engaged in mutual defense, letting each other know when the foreman is coming around, so often they have to look like they're working hard. Basically communicating and sharing information in ways that changes the preferences of workers towards each other. They become part of a community rather than simply separate individuals competing with each other. Marx makes the point that in the labor market, workers are competing with each other, but in production, they constitute a kind of community where they work with each other and cooperate with each other. And that does affect the argument would go, and this is an argument that Elster makes, an endogenous transformation of preferences. Okay, so that's the first thing that happens. That's the first empirical context, so that we can understand why it is that solidarity emerges with concentration and interdependence of workers. Well, the answer Elster offers is that concentration and interdependence of workers both changes preferences and provides better information about other people. So the conditions of the assurance game, both conditions are met. The information conditions improve, and the preference transformations tend to move in the direction of more conditional altruism and away from pure egoism. Okay, a second context, empirical context, for the formation of solidarity centers around community. That is, the extent to which you have stable working class communities that are intergenerational, in which people live their lives within particular communal contexts, where historical memories are reproduced over time about past struggles, and in which the identities of actors become bound up then with where they live and not simply where they work. The stability of a working class community, the argument goes, contributes important conditions for solidarity. Conditional altruist preferences are something which emerge through daily life and interaction. And if they are what the daily life and interactions within work are reinforced in communities in which one lives, if there is a correspondence between the character of community and the character of the workplace, this will strengthen the tendency for conditional altruism to be the dominant set of preferences, and it will also further help solve the assurance problems, because you live in a world where you have pretty big confidence in how other people behave, because they're like you, they live in the same sorts of places. This is one of the reasons why it's sometimes argued working class solidarity is weaker in the United States than it is in many European countries, quite apart from racism and all those other specifically American problems. Geographical mobility is orders of magnitude higher in the United States than almost any other place. And that's been true throughout American history. It's not just a contemporary problem. The percentage of the population that lives in the same neighborhood as their parents lived in is very low in the United States compared to most places. People move around a lot. Job mobility, moving from employer to employer, has always been higher in the United States, not just because people get fired and then they have to look for another job, but because American society has been organized around very open labor markets where people are constantly looking for better jobs, and they quit and look for a better job and are prepared to give up the camaraderie and the sense of community that they would have if they stayed in one job for a much longer time in the hope of individual improvement by looking for better jobs. That's a kind of individualistic view about your career, that your career is one in which you're constantly trying to maximize your own economic situation, rather than seeing your career as embedded in a community. That's certainly true among academics. You know, when I go to European universities, this is a kind of slightly overstated stereotype. They're becoming a little bit more like American universities, but basically, most professors were undergraduates and graduate students at the same university at which they work. And mostly, they work in universities in the city that they grew up in. You know, there are plenty of exceptions, but that's the standard. The standard story is that a professor at a university in Paris has lived in Paris all their life. They went to that university. They got their PhD there, and now they're a professor there. In much of the world, that's the pattern for academics. The idea that there's a national labor market for academics where there are rules against hiring your own PhDs, you know, it seems very strange to most places. As a professor here, when I get inquiries from students in other countries who are interested in coming to the University of Wisconsin, sometimes they write in a way that it's clear that they feel they need to, in a sense, be approved and adopted by me before they even get here in order to think that they can come here. You know, so you have to kind of have your the patronage system lined up ahead of time, as it were. And that's because working with a professor in some countries is much more like getting hired as an apprentice in a long-term relationship, which, you know, then creates kinship-like obligations. Now, some of that's true here. You know, when students work with me and with any professor after a while, you do develop reciprocities and kin-like connections. People jokingly, we hired as an assistant professor 10 years ago, now a tenured professor here, a PhD student of one of my early PhD students. And he was jokingly referred to as my grandson. One of my children had mentored him to a PhD. And so Ivan Ermakov is my grandson, as it were. So the U.S. is a case where this constant geographical mobility undercuts solidarity. And I think that's an important thing to think about. It's one of the reasons why what are called factory towns, you have these towns relatively isolated with a single factory and everybody works there and everybody lives there and their children work there and their grandchildren work there. This is sort of late 19th to mid-20th century phenomenon in the U.S. Those isolated kinds of communities tended to have very high levels of solidarity. It's one reason why mining communities in England notoriously had super high levels of solidarity. There was this isomorphism between work and community, and then communities were very stable, multi-generational workers the sons of miners fully expected to become miners, and therefore they had that prospective time horizon as well. So that's the second empirical context then in which we can understand solidarity formation. You can ask yourself the question about different times and places. Does the relationship between work and community reinforce or undermine conditional altruism? The conditional altruism that gets formed, those preferences that get formed at work, are they reinforced in the community or are they undermined in the community? And are the information conditions of assurance about other people's behavior reinforced or undermined in community? The third context in which Elster talks about the empirical settings for an assurance game and conditional altruism, the third context centers around leadership, the relationship between leadership and activists and organization. This, I thought, was really especially interesting and, you know, could form the basis for a kind of comparative study of different kinds of organizational forms and leadership structures and how they provide the conditions or facilitate the conditions of conditional altruism. Elster, in Making Sense of Marx, writes about it this way. If one individual knows and is trusted by 100 people, he can create the information conditions by 200 transactions. First, asking each of them about their willingness to join the collective action, and then telling each about the willingness of everyone else. So if one person knows 100 people, 200 transactions is all that is needed to provide full information to everybody. By contrast, bilateral communication between the 100 will require about 5,000 acts of communication. The information gains from leadership can be quite substantial. Now, what Elster then is emphasizing is that what leaders accomplish is solving an otherwise very complex information problem for which they must be trusted. That is, a leader can't do that unless the leader, him or herself, is highly trusted by the rank and file or the relevant constituencies. The leader is highly trusted if workers have seen the leader in the context of struggles come through for them and abandon them in the midst of struggle. If workers see leaders willing to make considerable sacrifices for the success of collective actions. So the workers have confidence in the leaders in question. Then leaders can solve this important information problem by raising the confidence level, the assurance level that people have about the intentions and purposes and willingness to act of others. Now, leaders, of course, do many other things. Leaders are strategists. They are very good at reading subtle aspects of a situation, so their judgment is good. That a good leader is one that knows when and when not to strike, because the leader has the kind of intelligence and feel of the game that enables them to realize when employers are likely to be vulnerable and when not, in a way that ordinary workers wouldn't be able to know. A good leader is one that will assess the prospects of a particular context, not from the vantage point of how pissed off they are at the management, but how realistic is a given form of struggle. And that's another aspect of the confidence that members of an organization would have in a leader. They have confidence in their wisdom, not just their honesty, not just their trustworthiness. As I briefly explained in answer to one question, this argument about leadership also applies, is also embedded in an argument about activism more generally. Remember the threshold model? And this has to do with the nature of the conditionality of conditional altruism. This is a theme which I don't think in the distinctively Marxian tradition has been given a lot of explicit attention. In the social movement literature it has. But it's entirely compatible with the Marxist concern about class solidarity. The idea basically is this: conditional altruism, the conditionality of conditional altruism really has two dimensions. One is, what's your confidence in how other people are going to behave? And the second is, what's your threshold? And how many people have to go along with you before you're prepared to be a collective actor? And as I explained briefly, some people will be prepared to join a struggle and be prepared to make sacrifices so long as they know they're not going to be alone. So as long as they know there's a small number of other people that will join them. They don't want to be a sucker and just go out on their own. But if they know there's 100 other people that will go out on the risky demonstration or the wildcat strike, that's enough for them to feel prepared to make their contribution. Other people will need 500 people to go out before they're prepared to go out. They don't want to go out with 100, for whatever reasons, either because they only want to engage in struggles where they are really protected, they're less vulnerable, or because they think 100 isn't going to accomplish anything and they only want to engage in struggles that have a possibility of really succeeding. So some people will only go out if 500 are willing to go out. Now let us suppose there are 500 people who are prepared to go out so long as 100 are prepared to go out. Well, that's a, and there's 1,000 people who are prepared to go out as soon as 500 go out. Well, that's a very nice set of thresholds, because you get a cadre of activists who are going to go out if only a few go out. Turns out that there is enough of those, there's 100 of them, so that 500 people immediately join because they're prepared to go out as long as 100 people go out. And then suddenly you have 600 people out. And then you get 10,000 people who are willing to join because they're prepared to join as soon as you get 600 people out. And so that's how you get these explosions. And you get broad participation if the thresholds are right in these conditions. Well, this is an important role then that activists play, because activists can get the ball rolling. Activists are the people who really commit themselves as a life decision to this kind of role. They're much less concerned about how many other people are prepared to cooperate, and much more willing to be in the game for the long haul because they feel it's the way they want to live their lives. So it's much more deeply part of their identity to participate in collective struggles. If you get an activist culture with enough people of that sort, that can then provide this hardcore at the center of movements, which then make it very easy, or easier, when there are historical conditions for larger movements and for other people to join. Organization then, political parties, trade unions, organizations become especially important because organizations make it possible for people to make an activist career. An activist career isn't just an individual act of will. An activist career is being part of an organization that facilitates that kind of life. And that consolidates this core of participants, which then makes the conditionality of others more flexible. And that's then another, that's the third kind of empirical context that Elster discusses, in which some of the problems of conditional altruism get solved through the formation, in this case, of solidaristic organizations, not just solidaristic persons. It's also why this perspective, although it's focused on individuals, should not really be regarded as an individualistic account. Right? A purely individualistic account is only concerned with the state of minds and strategies of individuals as such. What this argument really shows is that it's how individuals become interconnected. Organization is a particular form of interconnection, has a particular form of stability. A political party is a particular way of forging relations among relations, forging social relations among the social relations among people. So that the individual activists who are the core of a political party do not merely have mutual relations to each other of shared political sentiment. The relations among their relations are consolidated with boundaries and with resources, with offices and so on. Those are macro facts about the context of individual action. And what the conditional altruist assurance game view of solidarity helps reveal is why those macro facts really matter. I think they're irreducible to the individual attributes, although they depend upon the individual attributes. They cannot be understood. Why they matter cannot be understood outside of the fact that they shape the way individuals act. But nevertheless, they cannot be described merely in terms of those individual attributes. That's what it means, I think, to look for micro foundations of a macro structure without collapsing the macro structure into the micro level. In that sense, I think Jan Elster engages in certain kinds of rhetoric which is misleading. He particularly, this might have been in the Marxism, Functionalism, and Game Theory piece, but it'll be especially in some things we'll read later. He argues for what he calls methodological individualism. I think he's really just arguing for the importance of micro foundations. The expression methodological individualism often means individualistic reduction. That is, that you can get rid of macro concepts. You don't need them. They're just sloppy shorthands for more complicated individual descriptions. I don't think Elster actually believes that. He does not believe that our social theories can dispense with macro concepts, and that they're merely shorthands. But sometimes he argues as if that's what he believes. All right, that's the end of lecture 12. Any reactions, follow-up, thoughts? Yeah.
Sorry, I must have like totally missed something. But what's the alternative to reductionism? What's the alternative with respect to methodological individualism to collapsing the macro into the micro? How is micro
So what it's acknowledging that relations are explanatory
between in micro actors,
right? And the relations among relations
would just focus on psychology
and the attributes of psychology and the resources and other attributes of those individual minds.
Right.
So methodological individualism, a true methodological individualism is also atomistic. That is, relations are not themselves explanatory. Now, one could have a view, although I don't know anyone who does, that the relations between individuals matter. So my relation to each of you is explanatory. But no relations among relations are explanatory. Right? Only primary relations between monadic, atomistic individuals are explanatory, but not the relations among those relations. Conceivably, one could imagine that to be. That would come close to micro-reductionism, because it would only allow a description that contained each person's relation to other persons. The only real entities are persons and their relations to others. But the total configuration of relations wouldn't be explanatory. That is, the relations among relations wouldn't be explanatory. But I don't know anybody who holds that.
But don't you already violate methodological individualism by saying relation? By saying like family includes categories like mother, father?
Well, I think what you're violating is methodological atomism. By the term methodological individualism is used by people. They describe themselves as methodological individualists, and then they feel perfectly happy to include in the attributes of individuals their relations to others. And that's, to me, it's cheating. Okay. It's used